Es ist mir eine Freude und eine Überraschung, wieder hier zu sein. Really good to be back at Beyond Tolerant. So I've been here in the odd years. I was here year one, year three, and now it's year five. So it's like the opposite of Star Trek films. It's only the odd years that I'm here. Today, what I'd like to do is I'd like to change your mind. And when I say change your mind, I don't mean I want you to reverse a previously held position. No, I mean I literally want to change your mind, as in rewire your brains. And that might sound like quite a difficult task, to rewire the brains of another human. But the truth is, we rewire our brains all the time, right? When you see something, and once you've been shown it, you can't unsee it. Well, that's because you've had your mind changed. Your brain has been rewired. Like the first time someone shows you the arrow in the FedEx logo, right? Between the E and the X, and then every time you see the FedEx logo, all you see is the arrow, right? You can't unsee that. You've all seen the arrow, right? Okay, good, right? Yeah. Or the Toblerone logo, you guys familiar with this? Who sees the bear in the Toblerone? About half the room. All right? So now the other half of the room have just had their brains rewired, because you'll always see the bear. Consider the duck. A perfectly ordinary, everyday duck. But then, somebody, usually on the internet, tells you, all ducks are actually wearing dog masks. All ducks are actually wearing dog masks. Wait. And I show you the same picture of the exact same duck. So I have already succeeded in rewiring your brains, but these are all very trivial examples, right, of having your brain rewired. There's much more important examples we've seen throughout history, like Copernicus and Galileo with their heliocentric model of the solar system rather than the geocentric model, and that changed our understanding of our place in the universe. And what's interesting about these kind of brain rewiring fundamental shifts is that nothing actually changes in the world itself. Right, the Earth always orbited around the Sun, not the other way around. And yet, after Copernicus and Galileo, everything changed because our understanding of our place in the universe changed. Or when Charles Darwin finally published his beautiful theory of evolution by natural selection, again, nothing actually changed in the natural world. Natural selection had been going on for millennia, and yet everything changed because our understanding of our place in the natural world changed with Darwin. I love this, by the way. This is a page from Darwin's sketchbook. It's one of my favorite sketches of all time, where you literally see the idea forming in the sketch he made. What it reminds me of is this. This is another paper. This one sits behind a glass case in CERN. Information Management, a Proposal. This is by Tim Berners-Lee. And this would go on to become the World Wide Web. This was something he had to present to a supervisor, Mike Sendell. And you can see what Mike Sendell wrote at the top. He wrote, vague but exciting. Right, gave the web its go-ahead. And in a way, what Tim Berners-Lee had to do then, it wasn't enough to just invent, you know, HTTP and HTML and URLs. He had to convince people that this was a good way of managing information. He had to rewire people's brains. This idea of this network that has no center, where anybody can add a new node to the network, that requires some fundamental shifts. And the idea that anybody could access it. You didn't need a particular computer, a particular operating system, that this would be for everyone, right? We had to rewire our brains to get that, to understand this decentralization. And then comes the problem of designing, developing for this new medium. How do we get our heads around it? Well, at first, we kind of don't. At first, what we do is we take what we already know from the previous medium and apply it. Does anyone remember this book? Oh, yeah, okay, we're showing our age now. Creating Killer Websites by David Siegel. It's an old book. This was the guy who came up with the idea of using the 1 pixel by 1 pixel spacer GIF, right, and giving it different dimensions, tables for layout, right? All these hacks that we used to do to design for the web. They were hacks, but they were necessary hacks because we didn't have any other way of doing it until you know, web standards came along. But fundamentally, our idea of design was, how do we make it look as good as the printed page? How do we make it look as good as what we're used to from magazines, from designing for print? And of course, when you compare the web on that metric, especially 20 years ago, the web seemed woeful, right? 216 colors, you know, one font. It seemed pretty hard to create killer websites. But people, even back then, were making the point that this isn't the way to go around it, that what we should do is truly rewire our brains and accept the web for what it is. John Alsop wrote 15 years ago, he wrote an article, A Tao of Web Design. Who's read A Tao of Web Design by John Alsop? You are my people. The rest of you, please read A Tao of Web Design by John Alsop. It's wonderful, and what makes it wonderful, partly, is the fact that it's still so relevant. I mean, you can't say that about many articles about the web that are 15 years old, that they're more relevant today than the day they were written. Because essentially what he's arguing for is that we accept the web as the web. We embrace flexibility and ubiquity, embrace that unknown nature of the web, rather than trying to fight it, rather than trying to treat it like the medium that came before, right? As if it's a poor second cousin to print. But John pointed out that this isn't new. This always happens. What happens is a new medium comes along, and what we initially do is we take on the tropes of the medium that came before. So when radio came along, people did theater on the radio. And then when television came along, they did radio, but on television. And in each case, it took a while for each new medium to develop its own vocabulary. Scott McCloud talked about this very same thing in his great book, Understanding Comics. Different medium, but he noticed the same trend. We take what we know from the medium before and then apply it to this new medium before we really get our heads around it, before we change our minds, rewire our brains. And when I look back at the history of design and development on the web, I think the brain rewiring started to happen because of this group, the Web Standards Project. And when we think of the work of the Web Standards Project today, you know, we think of their work in convincing browser makers to support the standards, right? Lobbying Internet Explorer and Netscape to support things like CSS. But that was only half their work. The other half of the work of the Web Standards Project was convincing us, designers and developers, to embrace the web, to use web standards, right? Like people like Jeffrey Zelman writing books like this. I mean, I've met people who say that this book changed their minds, right? It rewired their brains. They weren't the same person after reading this book as they were before. I guess the central message that the Web Standards Project, Jeffrey Zelman, all these standardistas were getting across back then was trying to get away from this idea that your presentation and your structure would be all glommed together in HTML and separated out, and that we could do that using web standards like CSS. And so that we could allow HTML to be HTML and be used for structuring content and allow CSS to be used for presentation. Now, it's all very well to read this or, you know, have someone tell you this, but to truly have your mind changed and to, like, get that light bulb moment, I think there's one website that did that, and it was Dave's website, the CSS and Garden, right? I mean, this was a machine for rewiring brains. Like, I'd heard, yeah, okay, separation of presentation and structure, I get it. But then when you're looking through, you go, whoa, this is actually the same HTML with different CSS, and the design could change that much. That's when you really get it. Like, you remember that aha moment looking at the Zen Garden and going, okay, now I get it, the separation of presentation and structure. And these, of course, there's the third layer we have on the web, which is JavaScript, and that's there for behavior. Structure, presentation, behavior. That's the broad idea behind progressive enhancement, that we have these three layers of building, one on top of the other. And I usually illustrate this with the upper back torso of my friend Lynn, because she's really into web standards and this awesome tattoo, that we have structure, HTML, presentation, CSS, and behavior, JavaScript. And what this reminds me of is something I remember reading from the world of architecture. There's a book called How Buildings Learn by Stuart Brand, really good book. And he talks about this concept of shearing layers or paste layers, that buildings themselves have, you know, different layers that they built upon that move at different paces, at different time scales. So the site of a building is on the geological time scale. It shouldn't really change at all. The structure is also a fairly long-lasting thing. And then we build up. We build the walls. We build the rooms. And within the rooms, you can move stuff around on a daily basis, but you're not going to change the underlying structure very often, maybe a century or two, right? And I think this is useful for thinking about the web. I mean, on the web, I guess our site would be our URLs, the thing that shouldn't change, right? Cool URLs don't change. And then on top of that, we get our structure with HTML. That's what it's there for. And there's something in the design of HTML that it's really powerful, and it seems really simple, but actually it's incredibly powerful, and that's this fault-tolerant nature of HTML. It's designed to be fault-tolerant. So explain what I mean. Let's look at what happens when you give a web browser an HTML element. An element with an opening tag and a closing tag, some text in between. Well, the browser is going to display the text in between the opening and closing tag. Standard behavior. Where it gets interesting is when you give a browser an element it doesn't understand, right? It still just displays the text between the opening and closing tag, even though it doesn't recognize that element. See, why this is interesting is what the browser does not do. The browser does not throw an error to the end user. The browser does not stop parsing the HTML at this point and refuse to parse any further. It just sees something it doesn't understand, renders the text between the tags, and carries on. You all know this. This is a pretty simple facet of HTML, and yet this is what allows HTML to grow over time. But because of this behavior, we can start adding extra richness to HTML, introduce new elements, secure in the knowledge that older browsers will display that text in between the opening and closing tags. It won't throw an error, it won't stop parsing. And we can use that in the design of new elements to create fallback content. Right? The fact that Canvas has an opening and closing tag was a deliberate design decision. It initially came from Apple and it was a self-closing tag. When it became a standard, it made sure they had an opening and closing tag so that they could provide fallback content for older browsers because of that fault-tolerant nature of HTML. Browser sees something it doesn't understand, it just renders what's in between the opening and closing tags. We get it with Canvas, we get it with video, we get it with audio, right? Now we get it with picture. So this fault-tolerant nature of HTML has allowed HTML to grow and evolve over time. Because when you think about it, that the age of HTML is crazy. It's over 20 years old, and it still works. I mean, you might say it's a completely different HTML at this point, but I see it as an unbroken line, that it is still the same HTML that we had over 20 years ago. It's kind of like the ships of Theseus paradox, like your grandfather's axe. This axe has been in the family for generations. The handle has been replaced 3 times, and the head has been replaced twice, right? It's like this philosophical question. Is it still the same axe? And if you're thinking to yourself, of course it's not the same axe, because the handle's been replaced 3 times, and the head's been replaced twice, then I would remind you that no cell in your body is older than 7 years, and yet you consider yourself to be the same person you were as a child. Something to think on. And what this allows for, this fault-tolerant nature, is that we can grow HTML and therefore achieve a kind of structural honesty by using the right element for the job. Again, this is an architectural term, just the idea that you use the correct structure. Rather than having a facade of something, you're actually using the right element to mark something up. So using tables for layout, that's not structurally honest because that's not what tables are for. So an example of structural honesty is if you need a button on a web page, you use the button element, right? Seems pretty straightforward, and yet, time and time again, I see stuff like this, right? Maybe you'll have class equals button, role equals button, an event handler on click, make this behave exactly like a button. Like, call me lazy, I would just use a button, right? And then there's CSS, which we use for our presentation. And CSS is also fault-tolerant, which is also extremely powerful, and I think has added to the robustness of CSS. If you just stop for a minute and think about all the websites out there using CSS, which is pretty much all of them now, right? And you think about how different they are, how varied they look, how varied they are in scope, how different their CSS must be. And yet, all the CSS on all those websites, it boils down to one simple pattern. I think a beautiful pattern, and it's this. You have a selector, you have a property, and you have a value. That's it. That is all of CSS. We have some, you know, nice syntactic sugar so that the machines can parse this stuff, but this is it. This is what all of CSS is. And again, that is really powerful. And what's powerful about it is the fault-tolerant behavior. Here's what happens if you give a web browser selector it doesn't understand. It just doesn't parse whatever is in between the opening and closing curly braces. Again, what's interesting here is what the browser doesn't do. It does not throw an error to the end user. It does not stop parsing the CSS at this point and refuse to parse any further. Likewise, you give it a property it doesn't understand, it just ignores that line. Same with a value. Give it a value it doesn't understand, it ignores that line, moves on to the next one. And that's really powerful. That means as new features start to arrive, we can start to use them straight away, even if they aren't universally supported. Because what's going to happen in the older browsers? Nothing. And that's absolutely fine. So we get a kind of a material honesty of using the right CSS for the job, in the same way we get structural honesty with CSS. When we used to want rounded corners, we'd have to, you know, slice up a circle and put four background images in an element, and now we can just say border radius, right? So we get this material honesty from the fault-tolerant nature of CSS, just as we get a structural honesty from the fault-tolerant nature of HTML. Then, then this is, excuse me, JavaScript, not fault-tolerant, sorry. They better not be recording this bit. I don't want to hear this on a loop in the next break. I mean it. So with JavaScript, it's not fault-tolerant, right? And to be fair, I don't think it could be, because JavaScript isn't a declarative language in the same way that HTML and CSS is. HTML and CSS can afford to just ignore things that they don't understand, right? JavaScript's a programming language, it's a scripting language. You actually kind of want a scripting language to tell you when you've done something wrong. You want it to throw an error. Debugging would be really, really hard if every time you made a mistake in a programming language, your environment just went, don't worry about it, don't worry about it, right? So JavaScript will throw an error. If there is a if you give a browser some JavaScript it doesn't understand, it will throw an error. It will stop parsing the JavaScript at that point and refuse to parse any further. So it's far more fragile than HTML or CSS. Now that's okay as long as we use JavaScript the right way. As long as we're aware of that fragility in comparison to the robustness of HTML and CSS, that's absolutely fine. It's just we need to be aware of having safe defaults when we're building. And the safe defaults will be, well, your HTML, your structure needs to be in place, right? And your CSS, you can't rely on it, but if it doesn't work, it's not the end of the world. What I'm saying here is use JavaScript to enhance your sites, but don't rely on JavaScript because of that fragile nature. Again, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying don't use JavaScript. I love JavaScript. I've written books on JavaScript. JavaScript is absolutely awesome. But relying on JavaScript is a really dangerous game because of that fragility. I kind of think of it as like being like the electricity of the web. In the same way as in product design, you want to use electricity to turbocharge a system, turbocharge a product, turbocharge a building, but you don't want to rely on electricity. Jake Archibald, who's riffing on the Mitch Hedberg joke, put it nicely when he said, look, when an elevator fails, it's useless. When an escalator fails, it becomes stairs. So on the web, we should be building escalators, not elevators. Makes a lot of sense to me, right? It's a robust way of building. And yet, I see stuff like this. This is Instagram.com if the JavaScript fails. It has finished loading at this point. Nothing more will come into the page. And there are many, many sites out there like that. Effectively, what's happened here is that JavaScript has become a SPOF, a single point of failure, in a way that HTML or CSS are very unlikely to do because of their fault-tolerant nature. So it seems very strange to me when confronted with these three layers of the web, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, that we would put all our eggs into the most fragile layer, right? That we turn the one with the fragile parsing into our single point of failure. And it's all, you know, fun and games to point at sites like this where if you switch off JavaScript, you get no content. But that's not what this is about. That's not what progressive enhancement is about. It's not about people who switch off JavaScript. I mean, who switches off JavaScript, right? Browsers are making it very, very difficult for people to choose to switch off JavaScript. It's about JavaScript failing for reasons you don't even know. Maybe it happens on the server. Maybe it happens on the browser. Maybe it happens on the network in between. Just circumstances that are out of your control. That's what you want to be building in a robust way. This is Andy Hume puts it this way. He said, look, progressive enhancement is much more about dealing with technology failing than technology not being supported. right? It isn't, oh, we need to think about making it work in browsers that don't have JavaScript. No, you know, every browser doesn't have JavaScript until the JavaScript loads, right? Things happen, and you need to embrace that, you know, you're going to lose some of those packets. And if it's HTML or CSS, that's going to be okay. If it's JavaScript, that's not going to be okay if you're relying on the JavaScript. And what Andy's saying here, I think, was nicely paraphrased or summed up in a different way by my friend David, who said, look, it's simple. Build your apps so they aren't a twirling shit show of clown horns when JavaScript breaks. Right? Seems pretty straightforward. Or perhaps more eloquently, Derek Featherstone said, in the web front-end stack, right, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and ARIA, if you can solve a problem with a simpler solution lower in the stack, you should, right? It's less fragile, more foolproof, and just works. And again, now Derek's an accessibility guy, and he's not making the argument here that it's about access, that it's about, you know, reach, it's about providing the service to everyone. No, no, he's pointing out that from an engineering point of view, this makes more sense. Foolproof, right? Less fragile, just works. That's the reason to work this way. And what all these people are saying, effectively, is a reformulation of an existing principle. Principle by this man, John Postel. This is Postel's law, the robustness principle. Be conservative in what you send, be liberal in what you accept. And I see Postel's law in action all the time. Browsers, the way that browsers handle HTML and CSS, that fault-tolerant error handling, that's Postel's law in action. They have to be liberal in what they accept because there's a lot of crap HTML out there, right? So they can't throw an error every time they see something they don't understand. I see the robustness principle in action all the time, not just in web development, but in design as well. So in the world of UX, let's say you're making a form on the web. Well, you want to be conservative in what you send. Don't send a really long form with lots of form fields. Send as few form fields as possible down the wire. But then when the user is inputting into that form, be liberal in what you accept. Don't make the user format their credit card number or their telephone number with spaces or without spaces. Be liberal in what you accept. That's just another example of Postel's law in action. And I love stuff like this because I'm kind of obsessed with design principles. This idea that these things are there, you might as well make them visible, make them public, write them down, put them on the wall. Because design principles are inherent in anything that humans build. We can't help but imbue what we build with our own beliefs, with our own biases. And that's certainly true of software. Software, like all technologies, is inherently political. Code inevitably reflects the choices, biases, and desires of its creators. Right? We talk about opinionated software. The truth is, to a certain degree, all software is opinionated. And that's okay as long as you recognize it, as long as you realize when you're taking on the philosophy of the piece of software. So then you can decide whether you want to go along with it. A simple example, if you're using a graphics design tool like Photoshop to create a website, and to be fair, Photoshop was never intended for creating web pages, right, for manipulating photographs. Let's say you're trying to design a web page in Photoshop. Well, you fire up Photoshop, you hit Command-N for a new document, and the first thing it asks you for is a width and a height. Right, a very fundamental design decision that maybe you're not even conscious of making so early on in the process. At the other end of the spectrum, if you have a content management system, and that content management system has been made with certain assumptions about where the content will be viewed or what kind of devices will be viewing that content, and if in further years down the line, those assumptions turn out not to be true, you're basically butting heads with the people who created that software, right? So with any piece of software, you need to evaluate it on that basis. You know, if you're choosing a framework, a front-end library or something, there's all these different things to evaluate. What's the file size? What's the browser support? What's the community like? All really important questions, but actually the most important question is, does the philosophy of this piece of software match my own philosophy? That way, if it does, you'll work with it. Right? It's a tool, it'll make you work faster, and that's the whole idea. If it doesn't match your philosophy, you're going to be fighting it the whole way. This is why it's possible for one group of developers to say, this framework rocks, and another group to say, this framework sucks, right? They're both right, and they're both wrong at the same time. It's entirely subjective. So we have a whole bunch of different tools we use in web development, and I kind of put them into different buckets, but these ones have become particularly popular in recent years, sort of bigger JavaScript libraries, worryingly people putting more of the core content and functionality into the most fragile layer of the stack. And I've sort of arranged them here in increasing order of opinionatedness. right? So if I'm trying to work in a progressive enhancement kind of way, and I take a look at Backbone, yeah, I could probably make it work. You know, it does URL routing, a fairly light touch. I can probably work with it. Let me get to Angular. It's like, yeah, not so much. I mean, maybe I could use a subset of Angular and still build in this progressive enhancement kind of way, thinking in this layered way. But Angular actually has a way of thinking, right? There's an Angular way of doing things. And to get the most use out of Angular, you kind of need to accept its philosophy. And then there's Ember, which is like, no, very opinionated. Like, JavaScript is everything. Forget HTML. Like, open body, closed body. That's all you need. Everything done in JavaScript. So if you're going to choose to use one of these, make sure that you understand what you're taking on board. Make sure that you agree with its philosophy. And if you do, that's great. These are excellent tools that will help you work faster. But if you don't agree with them, don't use them, because you're going to be fighting the whole way. And you know, I was listening to an episode of Shop Talk Show, right, the great podcast that Chris Coyer and Dave Rupert do, and had John Resig on the show, and they were asking him about these libraries. Why he thought they were getting so popular, right? He, you know, would have a good opinion on this, having created jQuery all those years ago. And he said something interesting about these big sort of monolithic libraries. He said, you know, no one wants to think that what they're doing is trivial. I think there's really something to that. The way that these things are marketed is like, these are for complex apps, right? You know, you're working on hard things, you need a really powerful framework like Angular or Ember. And it's true, no one likes to think that their problems they're working on aren't that difficult. If you're at a cocktail party and someone asks you what you do, and you describe your daily work, and then they said, oh yeah, that sounds pretty easy, you'd be offended, right? Like, that's an insult that someone would say your work sounds easy. But if you describe what you do and someone says, wow, that sounds hard, you're like, yeah. Yeah, it is hard. So, you know, when these libraries are like, oh, the stuff you work on is so hard, you know, you need this library, like, yeah. I'm working on really tough problems. But these are frameworks for building elevators, not escalators. Tom Dale is one of the creators of Ember. He said something a while back. And he, by the way, is changing his tune. He's coming around to the progressive enhancement thing, which is wonderful to see. But a while back, he said, look, JavaScript is part of the web platform. You don't get to take it away and expect the web to work. Now, I disagree with this, but maybe not for the obvious reasons that you might think, which is that second clause. But actually, I take issue with the first clause. JavaScript is part of the web platform. What I take issue with is this framing of the web as a platform. I don't think it is. And again, this is, you know, language can be so important. Simon talked about this morning, the importance of language. There's this idea of political language, where our words can subtly affect how we talk about things. This happens in English a lot. You know, political debates, if you talk about collateral damage or friendly fire, right, weasel words that obfuscate their meaning. But also political language, like if you're about to have a debate on tax relief, well, before the debate has even begun, you've framed tax as something you need relief from, right? And the same way, talking about the web platform, and don't get me wrong, there's great people using this phrase, webplatform.org, webplatform daily, wonderful, wonderful resources, but the web platform, the web isn't a platform. You think about what a platform is, you know, it's an all or nothing system. And I get it from a marketing point of view when you put the web on the same level as something like, you know, Flash, which is a platform, or iOS or Android, which is a platform. It's kind of cool that the web can sort of put itself on that same level. It's kind of amazing. I could wake up and go, I'm going to build an application. Now, should I build it in iOS or Android or the web? The fact that that's even a question is kind of awesome, but it's a bit misleading. Because the way that a platform works is, okay, I build something using the Flash platform, and if you have the Flash plugin, you get 100% of what I've built. But if you don't have the Flash plugin, you get nothing. So 100% or nothing. Those are your options. Same, if I build an iOS device and you have an iOS app and you've got an iOS device, you get what I've built, 100% of what I've built. But if I build an iOS app and you've got an Android device, you get zero of what I've built. If I build something on the web, maybe you'll get 100% of what I've built, maybe close to it, 90%, 80%. But the important thing is that you don't necessarily get zero, that you get something. That if I'm building it the right way, using progressive enhancement, you're at least going to get the content. You're at least going to get the HTML. Maybe you'll get CSS. Maybe not all the CSS. Maybe you'll get some of the JavaScript. Maybe not all the JavaScript. The web is not a platform. The web is a continuum. To treat the web as a platform is a category error. And just as we made the mistake of trying to get our heads around the web and thought of it as print design, now we're making the same mistake as thinking that the web is software just like any other software. And so we can treat building for the web the same way we treat building for any other platform. The web is fundamentally different. And I see, you know, sentiments like this. Joe Hewitt, an incredibly smart guy, frustrated by the web. He said, you know, it's hard not to be disappointed by HTML if you've developed for iOS, Windows, or other mature platforms as I have. Yeah, if you're going to judge it on that level, as if the web were a platform, I totally understand where your frustration is coming from. But the web isn't a platform. The whole point of the web is that it's cross-platform, that it doesn't matter whether you've got iOS or Android or what plugin you do or don't have installed, that you get something on the web. But what you have to understand about Joe's frustration here, when he said this, what he was trying to accomplish on the web was, well, he was trying to get smooth scrolling to work, which, yeah, okay, that is tougher on the web than it is in native. And all of these kind of interactions, tapping, dragging, swiping, it's kind of a pain in the ass to do this stuff on the web. But then you take a step back and you realize, hang on. These are all sort of surface-level implementation details on an interface. No one wakes up in the morning and thinks about these verbs, right? No one's like, I'm really looking forward to swiping today. If you look below the implementation surface level to what people are actually trying to do, will these verbs become more important? Are people trying to find stuff? They're trying to publish stuff, buy stuff, share stuff. And then if you examine, okay, how can I make this happen? You find you can do that pretty low down in the stack. Usually just HTML will get you this far. And then you can enhance, and then you can add on the swiping and the tapping and the dragging and all of that stuff as an enhancement on top of the more fundamental semantic verbs lying underneath. I think something that's helped us get our head around this idea of what the web is responsive web design. And again, you know, Simon talked about language, the importance of language. You know, what Ethan did by coining this phrase and giving it a definition was he helped rewire our brains to understand the web. And it's interesting, in Ethan's article, when he first introduced the idea of responsive design, he references A Tao of Web Design by John Alsop, right? Building on top of that existing work. And it is another term from architecture, right? Responsive design. And I feel like it goes hand in hand with progressive enhancement. If you think about it, what Ethan taught us was that if you're doing it right, layout is an enhancement. Here's the first website ever, the first website ever made, made by Tim Berners-Lee, published on CERN. And this is how it would look in a small viewport. This is how it would look in a slightly larger viewport, slightly larger again, right up to a widescreen viewport. It's responsive. And this may seem like a trivial, silly little thing. It's like, hey, of course there's no CSS, right? Well, exactly. It starts off being responsive. The problem was never that websites weren't responsive and we had to figure out how to make them responsive. No. The problem was we screwed it up. The web was responsive all along, and then we put that fixed width on it, right? We decided that websites were supposed to be 640 pixels wide, and then 800 pixels wide, and then 960, the magic number, wide. So instead of talking about making a website responsive, we should actually be talking about keeping a website responsive. Right, you get your content, you structure in HTML, it's responsive. You start adding CSS, the trick is at every step of the way to make sure you're not screwing up the inherent flexibility of the web. And that rewiring of your brain is a different way of looking at the problem can make all the difference. But to think that way, to truly accept it, that that's the way to build, you kind of have to answer a fundamental question, and it's this question. Do websites need to look exactly the same in every browser? And I'm pretty sure at this point, we all know the answer. And if you don't know the answer, you can find out by going to the URL, do websites need to look exactly the same in every browser.com, built by Dan Cederholm, where you can see the answer, which is no. But depending on the user agent that you happen to be visiting the site with, that will look slightly different because, hey, websites do not need to look exactly the same in every browser. And just to make sure that we're all on the same page here, I'm going to ask for just one piece of audience participation. If you could help me answer this question, please, ladies and gentlemen, do websites need to look exactly the same in every browser?
No.
Good, that was just pretty resounding. And that's great, because if you truly believe that, if you accept that, then suddenly all the stuff that we're afraid of, like, oh my God, there's so many devices, so many different browsers, right? So many different APIs, so many different screen sizes. All of this stuff that we're frightened of, if you accept that websites do not need to look the same in every browser, then it stops being something to be frightened of. It becomes something to embrace, right? It actually starts to get really fun. I'll finish with an example of what I mean. I'll show you a pattern. And this is, I'll admit, a very, very simple pattern. It's a navigation pattern. But to demonstrate sort of progressive enhancement, responsive design in action. This is a pattern I first saw on Luke Rabluski's old startup, BagCheck, where to reveal the navigation, you can see there's a trigger in the top corner there. And if you hit that, you get the navigation. Now, what's actually happened is that was nothing more than a hyperlink to a fragment identifier at the bottom of the page. And you were jumped down to the bottom of the page where the navigation sits. And I really, really like this pattern because that's going to work everywhere, right? Following links, that's pretty much what browsers do. So you know that if you start with this, it's going to work everywhere. And I've used it on websites, right? Have that trigger. You hit the trigger. It's going to go down to the navigation. Have something to dismiss the navigation. Actually, all that's happening under the hood is you're just jumping to a different part of the same page. But here's the great thing about progressive enhancement, about building for the web, is that you don't have to stop here. Now that you got that working, you got something that works literally everywhere, you can build on top of that. You can enhance that. So a website I was working on with Stephanie, actually, we had some various navigation stuff going on. So you got search, you got the more link, you got the menu. And to begin with, all of that worked the same way. There were hyperlinks to fragment identifiers further down the page, and you just followed those links. But then I was able to enhance and say, okay, well, what if when you hit search, it slides in from the top? We can do that. JavaScript, CSS, we can do that. What if that more menu is overlaid as sort of progressive disclosure on top of the content? Yeah, we can absolutely do that. Let's have that menu slide in that off-canvas kind of way. Absolutely, not a problem. And if any of that doesn't work, that's fine. Websites do not need to look the same or behave the same in every browser. Now, in order to do this, I'm going to have to make sure that the browser understands the JavaScript I'm using, because remember, JavaScript isn't fault-tolerant. I don't need to test for HTML. I don't need to test for CSS. I do need to test for JavaScript. And the BBC have this lovely phrase they use called cutting the mustard, where you're literally checking to see if the browser understands what you're about to do. So in my situation, I was using query selector, and I was using add event listener. So I have an if statement to say, if you understand these things, great, we're going to do some JavaScript. And that's it. There's two interesting things to notice about this pseudocode here. One is I am detecting features. I am not detecting browsers. I am not looking at a browser user agent string. And after listening to PPK, I think you understand why. Right? It's a mug's game. Just don't. The other interesting thing here is that there is no else statement. Right? If the browser understands these features, it gets these features. If it doesn't, it doesn't. Why? Because websites don't need to look the same in every browser. I'm not going to spend my time making an older browser understand something it doesn't understand natively, right? I'll give you an example. Let's say I'm using media queries, as I am. It's a responsive design. And I'm building it the right way, so I've got my usual styles outside the media queries, and then I put all my layout styles inside media queries. Well, some older browsers, like Internet Explorer 8, or 7, they're not going to understand those styles because they don't support media queries. So what do I do about those styles inside the media queries? What do I do about Internet Explorer 8 and 7? Nothing. It's perfectly fine. The content's well-structured, right? It can stand on its own. Layout is an enhancement. I don't need to make Internet Explorer 8 understand media queries. Now, let me check just once again. Do websites need to look exactly the same in every browser? Good. Marketing. Ah, that's a good point. So what I'm suggesting here is aggressive enhancement, right? You give the browsers everything they're capable of. And the other browsers that aren't capable of it, don't give it to them. Aggressive enhancement. But people say, I have to support IE8. Marketing says, you have to support IE8. You know, actually, I agree. You should support IE8. And IE7, and IE6, and IE5. I think you should support Netscape Navigator 3. Support. You should support those browsers, not optimize for them. There's a big difference between support and optimization. So there's a big difference between the marketing department saying, you need to make sure your content is available to Internet Explorer 8, and you need to make sure the website looks exactly the same in Internet Explorer 8. Two very different things. I will absolutely do the first. I support every browser. I optimize for none. Look, I know it's hard. I get it. Like, you'd be like, yeah, you haven't met my boss, or you haven't met my clients. You know, I think websites don't need to look the same in every browser, but there's these people. They think that they do, so I'm doing it because of them. That seems like such a waste of your time and your talent, that confronted with that situation, and you know full well that making something work and look the same in an older browser is just ridiculously hard and not the best use of your time, and yet you go and do it because the boss, the marketing department, whoever is telling you to do it, you're solving the wrong problem. If you are making a site look the same in Internet Explorer 6 as it does in Chrome 30 jillion or whatever it is now, then you're solving the wrong problem. The real problem to be solved is changing the mind of the person who thinks the website needs to look the same in both those browsers. That's the real problem, is to rewire someone's brain, probably someone in the marketing department. And I get it because, you know, that's hard. Technology is kind of easy, right? Give me a problem I'm going to solve with HTML and JavaScript, CSS, some code. Give me enough time, I think I could probably solve it. Human beings, yeah, they're hard. Much trickier problem. But you would at least be solving the right problem, right? Rather than wasting your time and your talent trying to make something look and work the same in an older browser as it does in a modern browser. But I do get it, because it seems impossible to convince someone like that, right? And yet things do change. It seemed impossible when the Web Standards Project was trying to convince browsers to support standards and convince us to use standards. Why would we switch from using tables for layout? We knew how to do that, right? It was never going to happen, and it happened. So it is possible. People can change. And there's a certain irony in this approach of progressive enhancement, is that you are, you know, making sure that things are going to work further down the line as well, and devices that you can't predict. The irony here is that the best way of being future-friendly is to be backwards compatible. And there's this idea that progressive enhancement was maybe, well, it made sense 10 years ago, but, you know, it's an idea of the past. It's a different web now. We've moved on. No. Progressive enhancement is the one idea that has stood the test of time so well, right? It's a technology of the future. It's not a technology, but a way of thinking for the future, right? Today, we're thinking about screens still. What about interfaces that don't even use screens? That's when you really have to think about your structured content first, right? Or what about if the network isn't available? This whole idea of offline first. What if we start thinking about the network itself as an enhancement? Again, this way of thinking, progressive enhancement, that will stand you in good stead. You know what's funny is I showed you the first website ever made, but I showed it to you in a modern web browser. And straight away, when you stop and think about that, that's kind of amazing, right? I showed you a website that's over 20 years old and it still worked in a modern browser. This is what it would have looked like at the time, right? This is the kind of browser it was around, something like the line mode browser. Here's what's really amazing. If you're building your websites the right way, you could take a website that you've built today and you could look at it in a browser from 20 years ago. Kind of mind-boggling, but that's exactly the idea behind the web, that anybody could get at that, that this is for everyone. I saw a tweet go by and said, wow, you really don't get the momentous idea of the web until you sit next to a guy with an old Nokia and another with a brand new iPad. Now that is an idea that's worth rewiring your brains for. Thank you.